Hello, friends. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying the ride, as always. Today's episode is with Dr. Pam Coons. Pam is also, again, if you've heard any of the others that have been posted, or are going to be listening to any in the future, you're going to see there's a pattern here, and Nanette's is it. That organization really brought a lot of us together, again, in different ways. But Pam is, I'm not going to define Pam. I'm going to let the episode define Pam, but Pam has done so much for medicine as a whole, and I think the neuroendocrine space and the equity space, specifically in female empowerment and making sure that our voices are heard. The first time I met Pam was my first Nanette's meeting that I attended in 2017, and it was my first real intro into the space and meeting all these people. And she gave a talk on work-life balance. And the thing that resonated with me at the time was that she talked about how she took a sabbatical in her first few years as an attending. And obviously, that's unheard of. I remember when I was in undergrad and grad school, and you would hear that a professor was taking a sabbatical. They were usually like 30 years into their career, and they were taking the first one for the first time. And so to hear that somebody had really the courage to say, I need to take some time for myself in that time period, it was eye-opening in a way that shouldn't have been so eye-opening, right? It should be normal to take breaks. It should be normal to be human. PM bringing that up in that way, it stuck with me. Stuck with me for many years moving forward. And over time, I met her in the beginning, and her career initially was focused on the management and the treatment of neuroendocrine tumors. From a clinical side, as a scientist, as a clinician. Over time, that changed for personal and professional reasons. Her career and her name have now become associated with female empowerment, equity, and with equity as a whole, and in making sure that everyone's voices are heard. I can tell you firsthand that I've had multiple experiences with her in which she truly has your back, and you feel like you have a safe space with her to come forward with anything that may be not necessarily the easiest to talk about sometimes. So I think Pam has turned experiences in which she felt like she wasn't provided that space, and now she's made that space, and she's made it her mission to make sure that everyone has that space. So just a really good look into how your career can shift, your purpose can shift, and your mission can stay the same, making things better for the people around you. And that can change over time. She's still a clinician. She's still killing it and taking care of patients in the most incredible of ways. But she's also added this layer of depth to her career that I think resonates with a lot of people. So I hope you guys enjoy the conversation. If you have any questions for Pam or for me based on this episode, please leave them, and we'll see you in the next one.
Hard things happening is really the value of pausing, being reflective, and keeping an open mind. And I think that instead of jumping to a conclusion, is really just being curious and asking questions. I think now I recognize that that's a very common feeling, and that women and underrepresented minorities or others who are minoritized are really made to feel that way. But it was a really terrible feeling, and I was afraid to talk about it.
100% agree. Like you said, you outgrow a lot of things, and it's not necessarily a bad thing
Right.
always.
I would encourage people who are looking for mentors, go around and ask, co-trainees or friends or peers, like who has a track record of strong mentorship.
First, like, light question. What's something that made you laugh this week? Like, really laugh?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. Probably something with one of my kids. I think my 16-year-old and I were like thinking about something last night. So,
Okay,
yeah.
fun. How old are your kids?
I have three boys, 19, 16, and 13.
Fun. 19-year-old, is he in school near you?
Yeah,
Yeah.
he just finished his freshman year of college
Nice.
at Wesleyan, which is like 45 minutes from us, which is
Okay, nice. What's your first memory going back to childhood, or whenever you first decided, okay, I want to be a doctor? What was that first conscious thought that you had? And who was the first person you told when you decided?
Well, I don't know if you've seen this slide, but I've used it in some presentations. I've like found this drawing that I had made. So I don't really remember that, but I clearly had thoughts around the age of 10 that I wanted to be a doctor. And then I found this. It was a part of this montage, like things I liked and what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so I had drawn a picture of me being a doctor. I think in true consciousness, really only figured that out after college and when I was working in a lab. And I worked with a PI who was a pediatrician, and she studied inherited disorders of metabolism. And so she did prenatal testing, saw children with inherited disorders of metabolism, like urea cycle disorders, maple syrup urine disease. And so I would see patients with her in clinic. I did some of the prenatal testing and I did some original research with her. And I really learned to love this mix of what I had been exposed to, which was like being able to be a clinician, but also do research. So that was like the clincher.
What did you major in college?
I was an ecology, like biology major. I had loved science.
Yeah.
Since I was little, my dad was a biologist and he was an ecologist and studied bats and was a university professor. So I was exposed to a lot of that growing up. And so I kind of thought I wanted to be like him. And so I knew I would do something in science, but I didn't know eventually if I would do a PhD or an MD or both.
Yeah. Was he happy when you chose the MD route or not really?
He told me that real doctors had PhDs.
So like, you're still not, Dad. You haven't reached the...
May he rest in peace. He's deceased. Yes. He loved that I was in science. And I think he was just, you know, happy that I had continued. And actually, like later in life, when I pursued a career in academic medicine, I think we also had a lot in common because he was in academics and wrote and edited and wrote grants. And so I think it actually gave me a really much greater appreciation for what he had accomplished.
Was he the person that you reached to review articles or proofread your stuff or not really?
No, when I was younger, and I still, I mean, that was before the era of computers when I was in high school and early college days. And I still remember him taking out his red pen to my writing. So I have both fond memories of that, but also just frightening memories of that too.
I love that. And then at what point did you decide neuroendocrine tumors and oncology, I guess, because that's a very niche field, right? That's not something everybody finds at any point in their life.
I liked oncology as a medical student. I remember a few specific patients. And actually, I remembered a teenager who had cancer that I, as a medical student, that had stimulated my interest in the field. And for a while, I actually considered med-peds as a kind of direction. Ultimately, I decided I just felt more comfortable in the adult medicine space. Yeah. And when I was a resident, I didn't go into residency knowing I wanted to go into oncology. I ultimately was really drawn to patients where I could have continuity relationships, patients who had complex needs, patients who were sick. I really embraced and loved the idea of building a doctor-patient relationship over challenging and difficult topics. And so ultimately it really came down to cardiology and actually heart failure and oncology. And I think what tipped me over into oncology is that this was sort of in the early 2000s, really at the advent of biologics. And I remember when bevacizumab or Avastin was like first approved, and just the science of oncology was really exciting. And I could just see that there would be this trajectory. So neuroendocrine tumors was a total accident. It was a little like much in life, a mix of serendipity and interest. So GI oncology was something that was more intentional. I really wanted a mix of diseases, a mix of gender, age. I really had great mentorship in that space. And ultimately, there was a senior fellow who was leaving who had a project that he said, hey, will you take over a couple of these GI cancer topics? And also at the time, there was very little known about neuroendocrine tumors. So I had a mentor say to me, it's a lot easier to become an expert in a rare disease. Thus, sort of, I fell into neuroendocrine tumors. And for a long time, I actually did a combination of upper GI and neuroendocrine tumors, and then eventually pivoted fully to NETs.
I love that. What's a misconception that you think clinicians to this day still have about NETs that we haven't squashed?
that they're rare and they won't see them.
Yeah.
And I think that more and more doctors, whether they be primary care physicians, endocrinology, gastroenterology, will come across NETs. And I know you know this, but they're really becoming more prevalent. And I think that we need to just raise awareness.
Yeah. Do you think, because I think about this a lot and I can't really decide on when the best time to increase efforts in terms of education, advocacy, and injecting the awareness and knowledge gap. Is it in ER medicine? Is it in primary care? Is it in, you know, GI, like gastroenterology in general? Where do you think the biggest yield would be that if we put our efforts into kind of getting people to identify it a lot quicker?
That's a great question. I mean, I think it really is probably across all specialties. It's such a multidisciplinary field that we need awareness across the board, including pathology and radiology. And so probably highest yield are going to be frontline. So primary care and gastroenterology are probably two of the groups that these patients will see earlier. And just to have it as part of the differential diagnosis. And I think the challenge is that many patients present with vague nonspecific symptoms. So that makes it hard to diagnose based on symptoms alone.
Yeah. But I guess you're right. If you know that it's part of your differential, then it's something that you'll explore as opposed to pushing it off to the side and maybe dealing with it later. I remember my first, not interaction with you, but my first time I met you was my first NANETS meeting that I attended. I saw this young woman on the stage and you were talking about how you had taken a sabbatical early on and the work-life balance. And you do need to give that talk again sometime soon. But that was one that really pulled me to the field. And I remember seeing you and Emily Bergsland and Diane Reedy. I remember that year. You guys were all on the stage at one point or another. And I was already starting to get interested in NETs. And I saw people that looked like the kind of life that I wanted to have or the kind of person that I would fit those shoes. And you were these, for lack of a better word, badass women in the field that were doing a million different things. And at the time, your career was focused just on neuroendocrine tumors. You hadn't pivoted into the equity work that you're known for and doing so much of right now. But I think inherently it was in your messaging, right? In finding that bridge between that academic love and that love for the career, love for the job, but then also love for everything else that makes you a woman and that keeps you sane as a person as well. Did you always know that you were going to pivot into that equity space, or was that something that organically happened? And when did you realize that this was another passion of yours?
No, that was totally an accident. And I think that's like a good life lesson, is just to be open to the fact that your path may shift and you have to look for signs of that. And no, that was not a part of the plan. And I think that it's something based on my own personal experiences with gender discrimination in the workforce that really forced me to think deeply about like what mattered to me and what my own values were, so that I could really use that as my guiding light. And in order to be true to myself, I felt that I had to really speak up, and I didn't want others to experience the same things that I did. And I felt that I really wanted to be a lever for change. And I think it came at the right time in my career, because I think it's really hard to lean into that when you're super junior and potentially more vulnerable. I was at a place in my career where I had a little bit more safety and leverage and was switching to a new institution and changing jobs and had an opportunity to kind of reinvent myself. I think, you know, I was still a GI oncologist and a clinical trialist focused on NETs, but then I had this other aspect of my career that was being celebrated. And I think that the timing was right at that point, 2020 in the world for people being ready to have those conversations.
How comfortable are you talking a little bit about your experience?
Yeah, I'm happy to.
Please do. Yes, I'd love to hear.
You know, so I think I've since realized that many women have similar experience. So I had excellent mentorship training. This was at Stanford University, and I felt really supported and was unaware of gender or sex-based differences in how I was treated or in my training. And it was really only when I became kind of more mid-career faculty that I started noticing that I was being treated differently and had different opportunities, that my promotion timeline was longer than other male colleagues. And I was simultaneously growing really unhappy to the point where I think I was clinically depressed. This only really came to light because I was taking a leadership course on mindfulness in leadership. And with that, we had small group sessions and we had access to one-on-one executive coaching. And I was new to executive coaching at the time. I didn't know what that was. And it was through this coach who I still work with to this day, did lots of reading. One of the books we read was Brené Brown's Dare to Lead. And there's a chapter on that around doing a value inventory of what matters to you. And I was really doing some deep soul searching about what made me happy. Was I unhappy because of inherent things to me? Was I unhappy because of my environment? And Adam Grant, an organizational psychologist who I think many of us know his name, has also written about this disconnect. People become unhappy when their values do not match their goals. And so I had a work environment that really was a mismatch with what my values were and what was important to me. And then in terms of the environment really enabled gender discrimination. And gender discrimination can run the gamut from overt sexual misconduct to microaggressions. I personally experienced microaggressions in the form of put downs, undermining leadership opportunities, I think lost opportunities for promotion. And ultimately, I just felt that I couldn't stay in the environment that I was in and chose to leave. Now, not everybody has the opportunity or flexibility to do so. So I recognize that. And I think that I was also in a position where, because I was more mid-career, had really felt this both obligation, but had a little bit of more safety in speaking up. And so that's really when I started leaning into that element of who I am and wrote about it. Started speaking about it, started really in my head trying to figure out how I could connect those dots with the other aspects of who I was as a scientist and a researcher and a clinician, but that I could also be somebody who advocated for diversity in medicine. So it even took me a while to really reconcile how all those things were connected.
What was the hardest part of coming to that decision and then acting on that decision as a person that was in your shoes? And then I guess a follow-up to that is also for somebody who's experiencing something like that, but in maybe, like you said, a more junior stage in their career, even as a student or as a resident or as a fellow, right? You automatically assume that you are supposed to take on a little bit more, right, than others. And so I think those lines can get blurred. So what would be, based on your experience, your advice to people that are going through it at that point, how to deal with it?
Yeah, I would say the first thing that I recognized and really learned from my executive coach and from reading, I felt very alone when all of that was happening. I felt like I was the only one. I was made to feel like I had caused the problems. And I think now I recognize that that's a very common feeling, and that women and underrepresented minorities or others who are minoritized are really made to feel that way. But it was a really terrible feeling. And I think until I actually, and I was afraid to talk about it. So until I actually started talking about it, I really think the first people I talked about it with were my executive coach in this small group that I was in this leadership class with. Then I actually started feeling some sense of validation, and that really, it wasn't me, that it was the environment, and the environment that really kind of enabled the bad behavior, the people who were perpetrating the bad behavior. And then I started talking with more women. Then I got connected with women in medicine groups. Like it sort of snowballed, where I then felt this village of support. I also, ironically, at the time had not really dabbled at all in social media. And it was around that time that we were all also in isolation because of COVID. And so right. I think social media became really an outlet and a village for many of us. And mm-hmm. that became a real positive for me, because I think that it was a place where I also found support. And honestly, I was introduced to some really amazing people mm-hmm. through those connections on social media. So I think that part was hard. The actual move, on a very personal note, was like at great cost to my family. Yeah. And to me, to uproot a family during COVID and move 3,000 miles with three children and a physician partner, like that was really hard. I had an incredibly supportive partner, and my kids hated me for 6 months, but we're okay now.
We're good now.
I keep telling them, I taught you resilience really early in life. So
it could have been worse. You could just do that, do the guilt tripping.
But I think to answer your second question, it is really tricky when you are younger and feel more vulnerable and feel that you risk retaliation. Mm-hmm. And this is something I've spoken certainly to other women about. I would say my advice would be find people who can be an ally or who can mm-hmm. be a sponsor, who can sit by you, make you feel seen, valued, heard. And I think you just need to start collecting some of those people in your team. Mm-hmm. I think that I had not diversified my mentor team sufficiently. And I think that's advice that I give to junior people. Yeah. You can't put all of your eggs in the basket of a single mentor, because then often you get let down or mm-hmm. you outgrow mentors, like you sometimes do friendships. And I think that you just need to have a diverse team.
How do you approach mentorship in general, and as a mentee and as a mentor, because you're in both positions? And is it always an overt conversation, or is it something that tends to happen a little bit more naturally? And do you think that always has to be very defined?
I would encourage people who are looking for mentors. I think that you certainly can go around and ask, you know, co-trainees mm-hmm. or friends or peers, like, who has a track record of strong mentorship. I think that you want to watch how they carry themselves with other mentees. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a mix of being organic and deliberate. It's mm-hmm. you can't fake a mentor-mentee relationship. There does have to be an element of fit. But I think that as a mentor, then, I'm very committed and try to create structure around that relationship and teach the mentee how to mentor up to me. I recommend that mentees have agendas when they meet with me, that they learn how to navigate my schedule and work mm-hmm. with my admin to make sure that we're meeting. These were all things that I wish I had been taught sooner. I had a fellow, I can't remember if he was a fellow or a resident at the time, but ask me if I had the bandwidth to mentor him. Mm-hmm. I think that's a super smart question. Mm-hmm. As a mentee, you don't want to get on someone's team if they don't actually have the time to mentor you.
Right. Did you lose any friends or colleagues in this kind of shift in your career?
I probably did, but mm-hmm. ultimately it was my choice. Okay. And I think that's okay. Like, I think that it's like what I said earlier, as we all grow into our careers and our interests and what matters to us may shift a little bit, and mm-hmm. we become perhaps more comfortable in what we believe in, I mm-hmm. think that relationships are going to change. I think that that's okay.
I 100% agree. Like you said, you outgrow a lot of things, and it's not necessarily a bad thing always. Right. Do you feel like you still have the bandwidth for both passions of yours, the clinical side and the advocacy side? Do you feel like you miss a little bit more of just being a clinician, or do you love where you're at?
So I think it's a tough, complicated question, because I think also as my career has evolved, I've taken on more administrative roles. And so I think a colleague of mine, and actually my cancer center director, Eric Weiner, has always says that as a physician, we should anchor everything that we do in patient care, which I think is really mm-hmm. wise. And that can really bring us back to what matters. And then we sort of center everything around that. So as I talk about advocacy, I try to keep the patient at the center. So that advocacy, mm-hmm. both for the workforce and for advocating for what's important for patients, whether that be access or whether that be dismantling disparities, I think that, again, it all connects. So if I stay true to that, then I try to make decisions around that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that I have space for those things. I still have to make choices about what I do and don't have bandwidth for, but I still really love having that as a part of my career. I think that also, as I try to make sure that what I'm doing is aligned with what matters to me, mm-hmm. it is anti-burnout if I mm-hmm. still am able to have some advocacy in my life.
What was your favorite academic project that you've ever worked on?
That I've ever worked on? Mm-hmm. That is a hard one. Well, I'll answer. Yeah, there's probably multi-part. I'll start with one answer. I think one of the academic projects that I'm most proud of is the randomized trial in neuroendocrine tumors of ECOG 2211 of temozolomide versus CAPTEM. And I know that regimen is near and dear to your heart also. but I think that that was many years in the works. It was early in my career, was incredibly meaningful to my career, both in terms of what I learned, but the network of mentors I had from that and the impact I think that it's had for patients. So I think that, and that was through ECOG Akron, through National Clinical Trial Network, which for listeners is one of our very important federally funded mechanisms for doing clinical trials research, especially for rare diseases. So that I think has great meaning. I think that more recently, this was less a research project, but probably a kind of a culmination of a lot of the things that I've done, but was getting asked to give the keynote address at ASCO GI. And I think that that to me represented sort of this combination of my research, clinical work, and advocacy kind of coming together at a really interesting time. And so that holds a lot of meaning to me.
Yeah. How did that feel? I wish I was there in person for that, but how did it feel to, you're not new to the stage, but how did that one talk, like literally feel up on the stage?
I was nervous.
Yeah.
It was also 3 days after the inauguration.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting timing. I felt like some of the messaging changed from like minute to minute and hour to hour leading up to that talk. I'm really proud of what I said, and I think it still stands the test of time even now. And I hope that it, you know, inspires other people to really stay true to what matters to you and to lean into advocacy. I think, as I'd said in that talk and have said since, advocacy is part of who we are as physicians, and you can just define what you're going to advocate for. I think many of us inherently advocate for our patients, but there's this like deep history of advocacy for physicians and will be for the future for sure.
What's something that an ally or a colleague or anybody should adopt and that will always help no matter who they're working with?
I think that there's real value in when you're, I probably have a lot of things to say on this topic, but as I think about some of my favorite leaders and watching people that I think do things well, I think one is when there are hard things happening is really the value of pausing, being reflective, and keeping an open mind. And I think that instead of jumping to a conclusion is really just being curious and asking questions. And I think that some of the best leaders, strongest leaders that I've watched do that very well. I think that I try to do this, but I've watched others, is that really making people around you feel seen, valued, heard, because I personally experienced not feeling that way. And I know how that feels. And then one of my junior colleagues who I highlighted in my GI ASCO talk, I think Dr. Jacqueline Gaddy gave really nice advice, which was to mentor somebody who doesn't look like you. And I think that that is really wise, because I've certainly learned a lot in my mentorship of her. She's a young Black woman. And I think that we all can learn so much from each other's differences. And I think that that's will only help our work environments.
When you got to Yale, was there something that you wanted to fix but left alone?
I mean, no place is perfect.
It doesn't have to be related to this, but just in general.
Well, I think just as a broad general statement, I am, like many people, reading the book Let Them, that is very popular right now. And I think especially given the current environment where there's like a lot of just chaos around all of us, I think that really focusing on what you control is super important. So there are certainly things that Yale is a huge health system. There are a number of things that are hard for me to change and not worth me kind of head up against a wall. It's a 1,500-bed hospital. It has complicated kind of clinical infrastructure. Some of those things are really hard to change and things I objectively can't. And I think that it would be incredibly frustrating if I focused my efforts there. So I think I try to not, I don't always do this well, but I try to focus on the things that I can control. And then I get satisfaction if I can make, you know, nudge on those things and make some difference.
I think that's, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you feel any differently, but for me, that's one of the biggest things that I learned and decided, no matter where I am in terms of career, location, stage in life, I tend to evaluate this situation around me and then decide, like, let's say I want to escalate my career in terms of administrative growth, right? Like I would want to direct or I would want to manage. If I wouldn't want to do it in the place that I'm at, and the reason for that is I know I can't make the changes that I would want to do in that position, I won't put myself in that position. I will stay or I will leave altogether. You know, if the good outweighs the bad, I'll stay in where I am and then I will wait for the opportunity that I know that I can make a change. Because I feel like if you get into that, that's the first thing that fuels burnout and just losing your passion for what you're in. Do you feel the same?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. Us as individuals can decide, like, what are the deal breakers that will be where you cannot stay in a specific environment or that make you unhappy? And to your point, kind of staying true to yourself. And there's always push and pull in every situation, and no place is perfect. And so I think as someone, I tend to be a fixer. So it is really hard for me to sit back and to not want to fix things. And I think that that's been one of the biggest growth areas, due in large part to my coach, where I can't fix everything. So I have to decide what are the things that I can fix and that I'm going to try to fix, and what are things that I let somebody else fix.
Yeah. How would you describe the difference between a therapist, a personal coach, and then a professional coach?
It really depends. Yeah. I think, and it depends on the coach's training, to be truly honest. So my coach actually is also trained as a therapist, but she's a licensed executive coach. And she also only works with physicians. So some coaches have a therapy background and some do not. So my coach is truly a mix between a therapist and a coach. And I think I needed that. I mean, I separately have over the years off and on seen a therapist for various reasons. But I think that, and then I'll add that coaches are also cheerleaders. And that's a really important element too. So if your listeners are looking for coaching, there are lots of different types of coaches and coaches that have expertise in different fields. And it's really about finding a good fit. And so I've helped peers and mentees find coaches, and everyone needs something a little bit different. And so it's really just about exploring and asking around.
Who is the most intelligent person you've ever met, and somebody that you have like a distinct memory or story that you can share?
I might have to think about this one for a little bit.
All right.
Can I pause on that one?
You can pause on that one. I'll give you
That's a really good question.
Okay. Well, let you pause on that one. How do you decompress during meetings, and how do you decompress in your daily life?
The during meeting one is definitely the pause technique, which I think that I've learned to, after a meeting, not to send like an inflammatory email. I might write it and just pause on it. Or if I'm really frustrated, again, we'll try to really pause and say, like, I need a little bit of time to think on this. So I think the value of the pause, I actually teach that to my mentees all the time, that there's so much value in pausing in a professional work environment where you don't want to say something you're going to regret. We all can get fired up about certain things, but I think that there are ways to effectively communicate frustration that can actually then serve as being a lever for change. But I think that if you're inflammatory, that often can backfire. So pausing in the work environment. I have like a very busy personal life with the three teenagers. So we have like organized chaos all the time at my house. So it's a mix of running around to sports games, which I absolutely love. And I love being part of my boys' lives. Trying to do more exercise. So that's a big personal goal this year. Yeah. And reading. And I think it's mostly spending time with family.
Just spending time. Yeah. How do you find ways to intentionally? Do you have zero screen time hours? Do you have a rigid schedule when you get home? Or do you just take it day by day and just hope that at the end, there's somewhat of a balance?
It is not rigid.
Yeah.
I maybe should do that a little bit better.
Yeah.
But I try my best. But that's, I mean, this is something also that I actually talk with my coach about. So it is really focusing on nutrition, exercise, sleep, time management. She has her acronym for that is NEST.
Oh, okay. So, I like that.
Which is nice because you really do need to think about how you manage all of those things. So actually, one thing that's less about the personal time, but I think it will give me more personal time, is actually calendar blocking. A lot of people will do that, where I actually think that that has great benefits for life in general. Yeah. So really trying to be very intentional with how you use your time.
Okay. Rapid fire, a few things. A hidden talent that you think is totally useless in the clinic, but that you have.
I'm very handy with power tools.
I can see that. Oh my God.
Really?
I could see that. Category on Jeopardy that you could sweep.
I could sweep a category on bats because of my dad.
Yeah, I love that. Okay. A popular movie that you think is very overrated.
Oh, that's overrated. Can I still love it? But it, I think it you probably can love is it. Overrated.
Yeah.
Crazy Rich Asians. I love it, but probably a little overrated.
Yeah. It's a glorified Disney Channel movie, but I do enjoy it. A sunset or a sunrise, and why?
I think a sunset. I do not love getting up early in the morning.
Which coast has better sunsets? You've been on both.
I have been on both. I don't know. They're both beautiful.
Yeah, I
have a hard time picking, but they're both really pretty.
Okay. Is there a childhood commercial that you always think of? TV commercial?
No, but if I had to think of one, I come from the era of that public service announcements about drugs and the like fried eggs. Like, that's the one that I remember where you'd say, this is your brain on drugs. That's what I remember.
I remember like the milk ones and the smoking ones a lot. Those were. And then a 10-year goal that you have for yourself that you feel comfortable sharing, something that you want to check off.
So I haven't figured that out yet. Okay. So I think I want to still, just as a like general principles, be like living in my values, trying to do something that's making a difference in the world and in medicine, but also balancing that with my personal life and my family who matter like very much to me.
Mm-hmm. If somebody is thinking about getting into medicine right now, what's one piece of advice that you would give them, both for their initial undergrad time and then something to carry with them through medicine as well?
Yeah. Interesting you ask that. So my 19-year-old son is working in a lab around the corner from me this summer. So he is sort of exploring that.
Nice.
And so I think that medicine is still an amazing field, but you have to really be sure that you want it. I think that it's a long path.
Mm-hmm.
And I took time off between undergrad and medical school. I took 3 years.
Mm.
I would highly still recommend that to explore. And there are a lot of different things you can do with a medical degree, but I think you really want to be certain that that's the path that you want to go down.
How do you think somebody can know that that's the path that they want to go down? What is that switch?
Getting exposure in various ways, whether it's working as a research assistant or whether it's like talk to lots of people. What are the things they love? What are the things they don't like? It's also a field that can, that really requires a lot of you. So are you someone who is willing to put in that time? There are sacrifices that we have to make. And I think that I would still go into medicine. Absolutely. Yeah. Also, sort of younger generation does a better job of putting boundaries around things and setting limits. And that's really critically important.
Do you ever think that the boundary thing of the new generation goes a little bit too far or no?
It depends. I mean, I think that, sure, there are probably some people that take it too far, but medicine has needed boundaries.
Yeah.
And I was in the era, I started my residency just before the work hour limits, and the work hour limits were implemented in the middle of my residency. And I think those are important. They're important both for patient safety, for physician well-being. So we have to strike a balance. It's critically important that physician well-being is prioritized, but we also need to be sure that patients are being taken well care of.
And then before you answer the intelligent person question, if you have an answer, what's the net breakthrough that you think is actually going to change the landscape?
So I have been very excited about radioligand therapy, and I think that more broadly, I am hopeful that we think of other ways of targeting the somatostatin receptor.
It's going to be exciting.
Yeah. And I haven't thought of a...
You haven't gotten one. Person. Okay, if you think of one, email it to me and then I'll include it in the blog post.
Okay, I will. Sorry, I was not prepared for that one.
It's okay. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you would want to leave listeners with?
No, you did such a lovely job. So
thank you.
Pleasure.
This was awesome. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
I appreciate
you. Nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Bye.